Ah, okay. That's why you're supposed to stand in the pulpit. Good morning. I want to talk with you this morning about angels. But let me give you some sense as to why I want to talk with you about angels today. I would like for us to have a renewed sense of understanding of the fact that we are spiritual beings and we live in a spiritual realm. Of course, we live here on this physical earth, and we live here in physical bodies. And ever since the 1800s, when, what was his name, Charles Darwin, came out with his theory, it's been increasingly popular to believe that we are just physical entities and we're just the result of chemical processes. And it has taken about a century and a half, but at this point there are very many people that we interact with who really believe that all we are is what you can see, and when we die, that's it. And there are doctrines that come out of this. How many of you have heard of the 70 AD doctrine? Raise your hand if you've heard of that. It's also known as realized eschatology and various other things. But basically, the doctrine says Jesus is not coming back to this earth at a time such that there will be an end of all of this and the dead will be raised. The doctrine says that's not going to happen. And talking with some brethren recently, we've been discussing why is this becoming popular among churches of God's people in places? Why is this becoming popular? And I think one of the reasons, I think there's several reasons, but one of the reasons is because if I have this mindset that it's just hard for me to believe in something I haven't seen, then this doctrine that says, oh no, people aren't really literally going to be raised from the dead, maybe that's a little bit attractive. You know, in Acts the 23rd chapter in verse 8, Luke gives us a description of the Sadducees and their doctrine. And they were the materialists of their day. This is interesting because they were religious leaders. They controlled the highest offices in the priesthood, and yet they were materialists. They didn't believe in anything that you don't see. Luke puts it this way in verse 8, the Sadducees say that there's no resurrection, and then he goes on, neither angel nor spirit. It's kind of interesting that this idea that there was no resurrection went hand in hand with the idea that there's no such thing as angels. Josephus tells us that they believe that the soul dies with the body. In other words, they just believed all there is what you can see. Well, we know there are angels, and angels are not the key to everything, and I don't want to leave you with the impression this morning that somehow the gospel of Jesus Christ is all about angels, or that your salvation comes from an understanding of angels or anything like that. But I do think that maybe I can say a few things to you this morning, maybe things that you haven't considered before about what the Bible says about angels that will impress you with the fact that there is a spiritual realm and that we interact with that spiritual realm. That spiritual realm interacts with us. So we're going to talk about angels and a spiritual reality this morning, and I'm going to begin and end with this passage in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 14, where the writer describes angels as ministering spirits, so spiritual beings, sent forth to do service for the sake of them that shall inherit salvation. Who's that? Well, that's us. Do you ever think of angels, that the Bible teaches that angels are sent to do service for us? I want to go to Daniel the 10th chapter with you, first of all. Daniel the 10th chapter, interesting passage. In Daniel the 11th chapter, there is a detailed prediction of the things that would happen between what we know as the Old Testament and the New Testament, that 400 years of history. But in Daniel the 10th chapter, before the angel that speaks to Daniel tells him about all of that, we have an interesting conversation between that being and Daniel. So in Daniel the 10th chapter, it's in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. Daniel says in verse 2, in those days, I, Daniel, had been mourning for 3 entire weeks. It's kind of interesting to pay attention to that. He describes 3 weeks during which he'd been mourning and fasting, and then this being appears to him. There's a description of the being in verse 5 and 6. I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a certain man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold of Uphaz, and his body was like beryl, and his face had the appearance of lightning. His eyes were flaming torches, his arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze. and the sound of his words were like the sound of a tumult. I'm sure we could spend a lot of time just studying that, but we won't. I want to skip down to verse 10. Then behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my knees, and he said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem, understand the words that I'm about to tell you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. And then he said to me, Do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard. And I have come in response to your words, but I didn't come the first day. I've come now. I was delayed. Why was I delayed? The prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. How long is 21 days? 3 weeks. That's the period of time that Daniel was fasting and mourning and praying. And there was an awareness already, but there was a delay because the one who's going to come and speak with Daniel was busy dealing with the prince of the kingdom of Persia who was withstanding the one that was going to speak to Daniel. Verse 13 again, the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days, and then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia. Who's this Michael? Now I've come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future. And that's what he'll tell Daniel in chapter 11, all the things that are going to happen in the latter days. But verse 15 says, when he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. And behold, one who resembled a human being was touching my lips. And then I opened my mouth and spoke and said to him who was standing before me, O my Lord, as a result of the vision, anguish has come upon me and I've retained no strength. For how can such a servant of my Lord talk with such as my Lord? How can I talk with somebody like you? As for me, there remains just now no strength in me, nor has any breath been left in me. Then this one with human appearance touched me again and strengthened me, and he said, O man of high esteem, do not be afraid. Peace be with you. Take courage and be courageous. And as soon as he spoke to me, I received strength and said, May my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. And then he said, Do you understand why I came to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I'm going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. So here's this one talking with Daniel, and he's been dealing with the prince of Persia, fighting with him, and the prince of Greece is next on the scene, and he's aware of that, but he's getting help from somebody named Michael. And then he says in verse 21, However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth, yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces, except Michael, your prince. This is an angelic being that's talking with Daniel, but he's fighting with somebody called a prince of Persia and the prince of Greece, which is the next world empire to come after Persia. Somebody called the prince of Greece is coming. But Michael is on the side of the ones that speaks with Daniel. And Michael is called your prince, and your is plural. Not your, Daniel's prince, Israel's prince. We hear about a Michael the archangel over in the book of Jude, don't we? This is an angelic being speaking with Daniel, and there's a Michael, I'm going to assume this is Michael the archangel, who is helping him against the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece. What does that suggest about the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece? If Michael is the prince of Israel, then what about the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece? Are they not angels of some sort as well? This is an interesting idea that whereas we look at world events and we see conflicts between this nation and that nation, that there could be a spiritual thing going on behind the scenes that we don't even see. That maybe the world events that we see are a reflection of spiritual events and a conflict in spiritual realms. Turn to 2 Kings, the 6th chapter. In 2 Kings, the 6th chapter, and I should give you an idea of what we're going to do this morning. We're going to look at Daniel 10, 2 Kings 6, and Revelation chapters 2 and 3. 2 Kings, the 6th chapter, we have Elisha, the man of God, warning the king of Israel to avoid the Syrians, telling him, don't go here, don't go there, the Syrians are out to get you, so avoid those places. The king of Syria is a little bit puzzled because he keeps trying to lay the trap for the king of Israel, and every time he sets it up, the king of Israel isn't there. And he wonders how the king of Israel is avoiding him. And he thinks he's got some kind of spy in his own house amongst his own people. And he wants to know, well, let's read it. Verse 11. The heart of the king of Syria was enraged over this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, will you tell me which of us is for the king of Israel? And one of his servants said, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. It's ironic to me, the next verse, he said, go and see where he is that I may send and take him. If he's a prophet of God and he's been able to tell the king of Israel everything that you speak in your bedroom so that you can't get him, why do you think you're going to be able to get Elisha? But that's what he's thinking. And so he sent horses and chariots. Let's skip verse 13, the end of it. He said, behold, he's in Dothan. So that's the city where Elisha is. Verse 14, he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. And when the attendant of the man of God, the attendant of Elisha, had risen early and gone out, he opens the door, and he's waking up, rubbing his eyes, and he looks around. Behold, an army with horses and chariots was circling the city. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? And so Elisha answered, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. And then Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. What do you make of that? That sounds like an angelic army, doesn't it? But that was not a physical army, and it wasn't something that earthly eyes could see unless his eyes were opened such that he could see what was going on in the spiritual realm. Brett spoke to us during the 9 o'clock hour this morning and talked to us about the devil's devices. And he talked about the devil challenging our knowledge and causing us to focus on the prohibition and miss the point. And talked about questioning God's motives in Genesis, the 3rd chapter. Why was it God told them not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? And told us that the devil will lie to us about the facts. I believe all of that is true. How does the devil do that? How does the devil do that? Is it really the devil doing it? Or do we just say it's the devil doing it, but then we just say, really, it's just us doing it? The devil walks about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. There is a devil and his angels that are active in this world. Mechanically, how they do that, I have no idea. But there is a devil and his angels that are active in this world, and there is God and his angels who are active in this world, and there is a spiritual war going on between them, and that war is reflected in our lives. And we choose sides, one or the other. And when we choose God's side, we need to choose God's side with the knowledge and the confidence that angels are ministering spirits sent forth to do service for the sake of them that will inherit salvation. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12, is that where I want to go first? I think I want to go to Revelation chapters 2 and 3, and then we'll go to Revelation chapter 12. No, let's go to Revelation 12 first. It's not even on the screen there. I put that together hurriedly this morning. Let's go to Revelation chapter 12. In Revelation chapter 12, It says, a great sign was seen in heaven, a woman arrayed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. I want you to think, when you think of that 12, I want you to think of the 12 tribes of Israel. And this woman is the nation of Israel. Or more accurately, she's the people of God, who in Old Testament times were embodied in the nation of Israel, in the 12 tribes of Israel. And she was with child, verse 2 says, and she cries out, travailing in birth and in pain to be delivered. That's a figure of speech that is used several times in the Old Testament. The nation of Israel as a woman going through labor pains. And perhaps most famously in Micah the 4th chapter, where the people are described as a woman in labor. They're going into captivity in Babylon. They don't have a king. Oh, where is your king? Has your counselor perished? You're going to go into Babylon and you're going to be in labor, go through pains. But out the other side of this travail, what's going to happen? Micah chapter 5 and verse 2 says, you're going to get your king, and your king is going to come from Bethlehem. And so it's the famous prophecy as to where the Christ would be born. But what I want you to understand then is that in Revelation 12, where we have a woman crowned with a crown of 12 stars and she is travailing in birth in pain to be delivered, that's a figure that's familiar to people, familiar with the Old Testament, about the people of God in pain to bring forth the Christ into the world. And then we come to verse 3, and there was seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his head 7 diadems. It's not hard to know who that's talking about, and if we didn't know, it'll tell us down in verse 9, that's the devil. And it says, his tail, verse 4, draws the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stands before the woman that is about to be delivered, that when she is delivered, he may devour her child. And you'll remember that when Jesus was born, there was King Herod who wanted to kill all the babies in the environs of Bethlehem, hoping that would get this Christ who's been born so that Herod wouldn't have any rival as king. Well, what was that but the work of the devil here, trying to devour the child? And then think about the temptation of Jesus Christ, where the devil actually speaks with Jesus. And what is that but the devil trying to devour the child? And think about the crucifixion, and Satan entered into Judas, and Judas betrayed Jesus. And what is that but the devil trying to devour the child? And perhaps thinking that he has done so victoriously when Jesus is crucified, not understanding that was part of God's plan. Book of Revelation chapter 12 doesn't go into all those details. It just says the dragon was waiting to devour the child. And verse 5 says she was delivered of a son, a man-child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and unto his throne. So in this brief picture here, all the details of the life of Jesus on earth are skipped. And we just go from the child is born to the child is caught up to God. And then what happens? The woman fled into the wilderness. Now, I suggested to you that more accurately, the woman is not just the Old Testament nation of Israel. It's the people of God that in Old Testament times were embodied in the nation of Israel. But now the people of God, being the church, which includes Jews, but not only Jews, but also Gentiles, this woman flees into the wilderness where she has a place prepared of God that there they may nourish her how long? 1,260, or 1,260 days. Now we get to verse 7. And what I want to suggest to you is that starting in verse 7, we have that same scenario that we just read in the first 6 verses repeated. What does it say? There was war in heaven, Michael and his angels going forth to war with the dragon, and the dragon warred with his angels, and they prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he that is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him. And I heard a great voice in heaven saying, now has come the salvation, the power, the kingdom of our God, the authority of his Christ. See, this is talking about what happened when Jesus was caught up and receives the kingdom, and the dragon is cast down at that time. Think of Hebrews, the 2nd chapter, where I think it's about verse 14, Jesus Christ became flesh and blood. See if I can get it started. If I can quote it, I'll quote it. But I'm not going to get it started, so I'm going to turn to it. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14, we'll come right back to Revelation. Since then the children are shares in flesh and blood, he also himself, talking about Jesus, in like manner partook of the same. He became flesh and blood, that through death he might bring to naught him that had the power of death, that is the devil. Point of quoting that passage is, when Jesus died and was raised, Satan's power was brought to naught. Satan is cast down. Jesus is caught up. Satan is cast down. But then what happens in Revelation 12, verse 13? When the dragon saw that he was cast down to the earth, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the man-child. And there was given to the woman two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly where? Into the wilderness. Doesn't that sound familiar? Didn't we see that in the first six verses? Fly into the wilderness unto her place where she is nourished for how long? A time, times, and half a time. 1,260 days is what was mentioned in the first six verses. If you take 30 days to a month, that's 42 months or 3.5 years. 3.5 years, a time, times, and half a time. 3.5 years. That time, times, and half times, or 1,260 days, or 3.5 years, or 42 months, is a period of time that's used repeatedly in the book of Revelation and in the book of Daniel as a period of suffering, of hardship, of tribulation. And then what happens? We come down to verse 15. I'm going to skip the next few verses. I think I can make the point that I want to make here. So I have this little chart here. Skip that. We've already talked about that. Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 through 6, there's a child that's caught up into God in verse 5. A woman flees into the wilderness in verse 6. And then she is nourished in the wilderness, and the period of time is 1,260 days. And what I'm suggesting to you is, starting in verse 7, we see a repetition of this. In verses 7 through 17, there's a dragon that was cast down. The woman flies into the wilderness, she is nourished, and the period of time is time, times, and half a time. We see the parallels there. The woman flees into the wilderness, she's nourished, and the time period, though expressed differently, is the same thing. So that's why I say to you, one is a retelling of the other. Now there's a little bit of a difference. In the first six verses, the emphasis is on the child being caught up. And in the second six verses, or the second section, not six verses, but verses 7 through 17, the dragon is cast down. From an earthly perspective, what do you see? From an earthly perspective, you see Jesus Christ dying on the cross, buried in the tomb, raised, and ascending up into the clouds. The child is caught up. From a heavenly perspective, what do you see? You see the angel with his tail drawing a third of the stars, various supernatural beings, I guess, that come under his sway, but then he is cast down, he is defeated. There's a loss of his power as Jesus takes away his power, which is death. So what we have is two tellings of this scenario, one from an earthly perspective and one from a heavenly perspective. Now, look at Revelation chapter 12 and verse 7. It says, there was war in heaven, Michael and his angels going forth to war with the dragon. That's what's going on in the heavens. What's going on the earth? The dragon is trying to devour the child. Judas is betraying Jesus. Herod is killing the babies. We see something going on the earth, but in the heaven, there's a spiritual conflict. Michael and his angels at war with the dragon and his angels that corresponds to what's going on the earth. And when Jesus is victorious from the earthly perspective and rises up, Satan from the heavenly perspective is cast down. Now I say all of that to say, as we go through our lives and we have various conflicts in our lives, it's easy and tempting just to see these conflicts as just what we see. It's just a conflict. You've got a thief in your neighborhood. Some guys run around stealing things. But there's a spiritual thing going on there. And when we have in a marriage, when we have marital strife, it's easy to see it just from an earthly perspective. My husband isn't, or my wife isn't, or is, whatever the case may be. But there's a spiritual conflict going on there. There's a spiritual reality behind the scenes, and we are spiritual beings. And we're going to give account of ourselves to the Father of spirits. And we're deceived if we forget about that spiritual reality and our spiritual identity. Now, I want to do one last thing, and that is to go to Revelation chapter 2 and 3 and look at the angels of the seven churches, because this is an interesting question. And it has bearing on our discussion of angels and their interaction with this world. And there are different ideas that people have as to what the angels of the churches are. Some people think that the angels are messengers. The word angel means messenger. That's what it means. In some context, it may be a human messenger, but in another, it may be a spiritual messenger. John is on the island of Patmos, just off the coast of what would be modern-day Turkey. And the seven churches of Asia, remember in the Bible, Asia doesn't include China and India and Japan and all of that. Asia is just a little portion of the western end of modern-day Turkey. And it's where those cities are that are mentioned in Revelation chapters 2 and 3. John is on an island just off the coast, and so some people think that, well, these are just the messengers that are taking this message to each of those seven churches. Other people think, well, angel here is a reference to the bishop in each church. I want to argue that the angels of the churches are angels as we think of angels, supernatural beings. And let me see if I can show you why that makes sense. The word angel occurs 68 times in the book of Revelation. 8 of those occasions have reference to the seven churches, the angels of the churches. All 60 of the other occurrences clearly, indisputably, refer to supernatural beings. So right there, we've got kind of a tendency in the book of Revelation that John is using the word angel to refer to supernatural beings. But there's also the structure of the letters to the seven churches that is helpful to observe. The letters each have 7 sections, so there's kind of a 7x7 matrix, a 4-square kind of thing. First of all, there is the addressee to the angel of the church at Ephesus. And then there's the identification of the one who is speaking to the angel of the church at Ephesus, and that'll be the Lord. And then there's the I know section, I know your works. And then there is the rebuke and warning section, and this section is missing in 2 of the letters, of course. And then there is the encouraging admonition, and then there's the statement, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And then finally there is the he that overcometh section, and you'll find that in each of these. And the reason that it's important to notice the structure in this is because I'm going to make an argument in a moment about the structure, that there's something that's true in most of these letters that has to do with the identity of the angels. So you can't see that, and that's all right, but what I want you to get out of that screen right there is simply the fact that up here I have at the top the identification. This would be section number 2. Do I have a laser pointer on this? I'm not sure if I do, but that's all right. Huh? Red dot? Is there a red dot? Do you see a red dot? Okay, I don't see. Oh, wait, maybe I see it. Okay, I got it right there. All right. Do you see a red dot now? Well, I can't see it, so I don't know what I'm pointing at, so I won't I won't worry about that. But at the top for each of those letters, you have the identification of the speaker followed by the I know section, and I've skipped the other sections, and down at the bottom you have the last 2 sections, which actually get inverted after the 3rd letter. But we can skip all of that. That would be the identification of the speaker section. And what happens is the speaker identifies himself, Jesus is the speaker, in such a way that has something to do with what he's going to say later on to the angel of the respective church. So let's look at it this way. Ephesus. To the angel of the church at Ephesus, Jesus identifies himself as the one who walks in the midst of the 7 golden candlesticks or the lampstands. And then later on in the message to the angel of the church at Ephesus, what does he say? I will move your candlestick out of its place if you don't repent. Now we know why he identified himself as the one who walks in the midst of the candlesticks or the lampstands. To the angel of the church at Smyrna, or to the church at Smyrna, because the angel represents the church at Smyrna, he identifies himself as the one who was dead and then lived. Why does he identify himself that way to the angel of the church at Smyrna, or to the church at Smyrna? Because he's going to say to them, be faithful unto death, and I'll give thee the crown of life. How more appropriate is it to call upon somebody to be faithful to the point that you lose your life how more appropriate is it for someone to say that who himself has conquered death? And then in the next instance, to the church at Pergamum, he says he is the one who has the sharp two-edged sword. And he says to them, I will make war against them with the sword of my mouth. And in the next instance, to the church at Thyatira, and the angel of the church at Thyatira, the Lord identifies himself as the one who has eyes like a flame of fire. And then he says, I am he that searches the reins and the hearts. And maybe that connection is clear to you, but to me, and unfortunately, what I think of is Superman with the X-ray vision, you know. But nonetheless, the idea of someone who searches the reins and the hearts, the reins is an old-fashioned word for kidneys, and searching the kidneys and the hearts is the thoughts and the minds. And the idea is, here is the one who has eyes like a flame of fire, and he can see right into you. He can see your innermost being. And then we come to the church at Philadelphia, because for now, I'm going to skip Sardis. And in the case of the church at Philadelphia, the Lord identifies himself as the one who has the key of David, he that opens and none shall shut. And he says to the church at Philadelphia, I have set before thee a door opened which none can shut. So you see a pattern there. It's this pattern that's going to help us to identify who the angels are. Now, I don't have Laodicea up there because I haven't been able to see any connection with how the Lord identifies himself to the church at Laodicea and what he says to them. But there are exceptions in this structure. Remember, to two of the churches, there's not a rebuke and warning section. To Smyrna and to Philadelphia, there's nothing negative said. So there are exceptions, but the structure's there nonetheless. Now let's look at what he says to the angel of the church of Sardis. He identifies himself as the one who has the seven stars. And then he says to them, I will confess his name before his angels. Why would I think there's a connection between the one who has the seven stars and confessing the name of the faithful before God's angels? Because in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 20, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. So then in the message to the angel of the church at Sardis, when he says, I'm the one who has the seven stars, and then in that message he says, I will confess his name before the angels, then it's natural to see a connection between angels and stars, because we've seen this pattern, that how the Lord identifies himself has something to do with what he says to them. Well, what kind of angels are they before whom he will confess the name of the faithful? Who are these angels? Luke chapter 12 and verse 8. Everyone who shall confess me before men, him shall the Son of Man also confess before the angels of God. What kind of angels did we think those were? Supernatural angels, right? So then in Revelation chapter 3, in the message to the church at Sardis, when he says, I will confess his name before his angels, what kind of angels do we suppose those are? Sounds like they'd be the same as in Luke 12, 8, which would be supernatural angels. But in Revelation chapter 3, those angels are the stars of the seven churches, which are the angels to whom the letters are addressed. I think it's also interesting that in each letter, singular pronouns are used, indicating that whoever is being addressed, the angel of the church, is somebody who in some way is responsible for that church. And then it's just as true, though, that it's not just that individual who's being addressed, it's the church that's being addressed, because when there's a distinction that needs to be made between some in that church and others in that church, then a plural pronoun is used. For example, in Revelation the first chapter, and in or Revelation the second chapter, and in verse 10, when it says, behold, the devil is about to cast some of you, and then it uses a plural pronoun, even though the address is still to the same one that was singularly addressed previously. So the angel of the church is a being that is somehow responsible for the church at Sardis or the church at Smyrna or the church at Ephesus. And this is where this gets interesting. It sounds like there's an angel that in some way is responsible for each church. So there's an angel that is responsible for the church at Ephesus, and an angel that is responsible for the church at Smyrna, and an angel that's responsible for the church at Pergamum, and an angel that is responsible for the church at Thyatira. And then could there be an angel that is responsible for the church here on the south side of Blue Springs. Isn't that an interesting thought? You know, you think about what the Bible says about angels, and we see angels of little ones in Matthew chapter 18 and verse 10. And some people from this, I guess, get the idea of a guardian angel. And we kind of scoff maybe at the idea that each person has a guardian angel. And I don't want to make more of this passage that can be made of this. I don't want to say, okay, there's a unique angel. You've got your own unique angel, and you've got your own unique angel, and you've got your own unique angel. I don't want to go that far. But it does sound like that the Bible is saying that angels are looking out for us, which is what Hebrews chapter 2:14 said, didn't it? They're ministering spirits sent forth to do service for the sake of them that shall inherit salvation. And then we read about angels of the devil in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 41. It talks about the devil and his angels, and eternal fire has been prepared for them, but God has his angels. We see angels of kingdoms. We were back in Daniel the 10th chapter, and it seems like there's an angel associated with Persia and Greece, and I don't understand all of that. And does that mean some of those are rebellious angels rebelling against God, and some of them are not rebellious angels? Or are they all angels that are loyal to God, and yet there's some angels that God has sent forth to deal with kingdoms that are going to be defeated? I don't understand all of that. I don't know what to make of all of that, except that there are spiritual beings from a spiritual realm that are interacting with this world and have to do with the affairs that go on that we see in a physical way. How? How many of you ever saw Michael Landon in Touched by an Angel? Anybody? I don't want to suggest it's like that. I don't know how they do what they do. All I know is that they are ministering spirits. That means serving spirits sent forth to do service for us. Angels of churches? There were in Revelation chapter 2 and chapters 2 and 3. Angels of churches today? God is concerned about this congregation. And God has angels working on your behalf. Hebrews 2:14 says that. Now think about you as a collective entity, and the Lord sees this congregation as a collective entity. Could it be that there's an angel that is responsible for this church? So I said we begin and end with this passage. I've cited it 3 or 4 times. Angels are ministering spirits sent forth to do service for the sake of them who shall inherit salvation. The point of this lesson is not for you all to go home and to go to your local library and get all kinds of books on angels and see if you can learn all about angels. You'll become a Gnostic if you do that. You'll be into all kinds of genealogies of angels and all that. That's not the point at all. The point is to reinforce the understanding of a spiritual reality. We are spiritual beings. We are living here in physical bodies upon a physical earth, but we are spiritual beings. And there is a God in heaven who interacts with us, and he does so in part through these angels. And we're going to stand before the Father of spirits and give account for the things done in the body. But the body is not really, the physical body that you and I are in right now, is not really who we are. And so then as we go through our life and we have various struggles, whether it's health issues or whether it's personality conflicts or personal conflicts, relationship problems, or whether it's financial problems, if we can learn to look at those problems and not merely say, it's a money problem, it's a health problem, it's a relation problem, but if we can learn to look at it and say, it's a spiritual problem. It's an opportunity for the devil through his influences, however they work, to bring me down, to turn me away from God, or on the other hand, it's an opportunity for me to avail myself of the Word of God and what it teaches, knowing that there are God's angels at work in this world on my behalf. Then I can choose to do right, not just because, you know what? I'm going to solve my money problem, I'm going to solve my health problem, I'm going to solve my relationship problem, but because I'm going to resist the devil. I'm going to overcome sin. I'm going to choose to do what is right, because this is a war between good and evil. And I choose to be on the side of good. I choose to be on the side of God and his angels. That's the lesson for this morning. We're going to sing a song. I think the song is Nothing But the Blood. So we are saved from our sins by the blood of Jesus Christ. What can make me whole again? Nothing but the blood. So let's not go get the idea that, well, if I just learn enough about angels, that'll make me whole. No, it's the blood of Jesus Christ that is going to make me whole. But let's recognize that as we go through this life as servants of Jesus Christ, we are spiritual beings fighting a spiritual war. And let's overcome sin. Let's stand and sing the song that's been announced.